Why, thanks, Paul, and welcome back from the commercial. The second segment here, I'm with Donald F. Carpenter. He's the author of a book, The Family Man's Stock Market Volatility or Survival Guide, How to Defend Your Family in Any Economy. So, Donald, welcome to the show. Why don't you take a few minutes and tell people more about who you are and what you're doing and sort of the emphasis of the book you created?
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. And I really appreciate being on with you today. It's a great opportunity.
Good.
So, let's see, a little bit about me. Born and raised in Southern California, educated in Southern California, was the first person in my family to go to school. I was working on a PhD in ancient Near Eastern language at UCLA, and then I realized I needed to pay the bills. So I was a bit of a researcher and did some research on up-and-coming careers. Wall Street looked pretty good, applied to Morgan Stanley, got a job there, and worked there until 2005. Went independent, and I'm independent now. So I helped them, you know, sort of develop their financial planning platform for retail investors, and worked out pretty good. So I took that platform to my own company, and we've been doing financial planning and wealth management, asset protection strategies, and that kind of thing since. I decided that I probably needed to write some of this information down, especially some of the most cogent and important things. And so basically I have four chapters in this very tiny little book. It's a quick read. And those four chapters, are, I think, are the most important things that people can learn or utilize in you know, mapping out their wealth management strategies.
So let me ask you a question. So the people that you're dealing with, who's sort of like the sweet spot of the client that you're looking for?
I like families, hence the Family Man's Stock Market Volatility Survival Guide. And I also like really short titles. This one's only 15 words long. I like working with families. And the reason why is because they have purpose for investing other than just, you know, hey, how much can you make me? Or, you know, my Uncle Louie knows a guy who knows a guy who made a killing in the stock market. Can you do like, can you do that? Now, when I work with families, we're talking about, you know, the future of a lot of people and how can we protect the asset and what can we do to move that family's goals, dreams, and aspirations forward?
Well, you know, one of the, we have two audiences that I try to address on the show. One of them is the individual investor and the other is entrepreneurs. And when I look at entrepreneurs, I think for the most part, especially when they're getting started and getting themselves up and running, their focus is on how do you fund the business and not how do I make sure that I don't end up in the poorhouse. So I'm sure that that this is an audience that might be not only entertained but interested in what it is you're going to say. What are the top three things that you would recommend somebody do when they're thinking about this type of planning?
Well, I think there has been, and for very good reason, an overemphasis on making money in the stock market. And the good reason has been is that we've had an amazing bull run from the end of World War II up until the end of the 90s. And it was we created the baby boom generation in the United States created more wealth than any other population ever did in the history of the planet. So, you know, we kind of suspect that, you know, things might just continue on in that vein, uninterrupted. We've had a couple of interruptions. And I think one of the things that people don't always consider is that the generation is cyclical. So that same generation that spent a lot of money, bought second homes, you know, put their kids through college, had three cars in a garage, a vacation home, a timeshare or three, is downsizing and they're pulling back. They're not doing what they did to create all that wealth that they had at one time. And the generations succeeding them aren't nearly as big. And they also don't have the same orientation. I've been reading some stuff about millennials and Generation X and Xers, and they're a little bit different about wealth and wealth accumulation. Probably the segment that you speak to might be a little different because they're entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs tend to be a little more robust in their money-making efforts. But as a population in general, we're finding millennials that are shying away from the luxuries and the, you know, the just the outright extravagance that baby boomers seemed to really love at one point.
Well, you know, one of the things, though, I appreciate the fact you say that entrepreneurs are a little bit better in terms of managing money. But quite often, by the way, early stage companies in year four, year five, you find out the original management team starts to have odds with each other. And a lot of it is because they have all their investment in something that has no market yet. So right. You'll find some, you know, I've seen companies that have split up because, you know, one of the team wants to go one way and one wants to go another. And one is saying, but my daughter's about ready to go into college and I need some money. Right. So they really haven't, you know, that's why I said initially that a lot of times they've taken a lot of time in planning the funding for the business without really considering what kinds of things they should be doing for themselves.
That's interesting. You know, in the late 90s, Forbes wrote an article, I think the title was How to Stay Rich. It's in my book. Mm-hmm. What they found was that a good way to get yourself kicked off of the Forbes 400 list mm-hmm. was to have all of your assets concentrated in one particular company. Mm-hmm. And so most of the people that were on the Forbes list and then left, they didn't properly diversify. And it sounds similar to the situation that you're describing sure. with everybody, with entrepreneurs putting all their efforts into one project and having all their assets locked up there. Mm-hmm. And that's a good way to, you know, I mean, you can really suffer in a, you know, if you're not able to create the market you're looking for, or if, you know, something else goes haywire. Competition is always a, you know, a good part of, you know, taking away market share.
Sure.
You know, that could really affect, you know, that could really affect. That's interesting that you bring that up because I'd never really thought of that before. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's kind of like having all of your eggs in one basket. And man, I think the smart entrepreneur might start to diversify really early on, particularly if they had a cash flow they were peeling off for themselves. They might just set some of that into some other assets to actually plan ahead for, you know, the college education or the, you know, the wedding fund or the, you know, whatever it is down the road.
Well, the other thing is that I think that these type of people actually need somebody who knows what to do, because, you know, I don't know how many people have lost. You're better off going to Vegas and betting on red or black than trying to time the market. And so many people try to time the market and they're just not going to be successful.
Well, I think part of the problem, there's a couple of things going on there. So in 1991, Harry Max Markowitz won the Nobel Prize for, he basically created modern portfolio theory. Mm-hmm. And based on modern portfolio theory, all the big investment houses to the retail side used to say, it's not timing the market, it's time in the market. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that because Markowitz was using a very rare and unique period of time, post-World War to the end of the 90s, to develop his algorithms, that they started to break down after mm-hmm. after the year 2000, and they haven't really been as effective since. So we're mm-hmm. finding a return to market timing, but it's based on the somewhat antiquated notion, and you'll love this, that is completely despised by central bankers who are all neo-Keynesians.
Right.
and so they say, also, they push that same idea that you know, the followers of Markowitz were pushing, and that's that you can't time the market.
Right.
But if you become aware of and attuned to market cycles, your chances of surviving the economies that, you know, come forward are a lot better than if you're just sitting in the market waiting for it to, you know, do what it's done.
Sure.
Over the, you know, since post-World War II, because it's not, without the population generating that kind of economic creativity, not going to happen. Not in my opinion. I mean, I don't think it's going
to
happen.
No, and you know, in hindsight, it was easy to be able to identify what happened in 2000, 2002 with the tech market. And also what happened in 2008, 2009 with the subprime industry. But no one knows today, for example, what happens with Brexit. I mean, is, you know, there's a lot of things being published right now about, do you have your assets in the right place based upon how negatively Brexit could affect people in the United States.
Yes, the initial estimates were, and again, they were neo-Keynesian. Sorry, guys, but they were that, you know, it was pretty much going to fall apart. If you look at some of the recent reports and the actual numbers coming out of Britain, I mean, mm-hmm. they're going pretty strong. They're doing a little bit better than the rest of Europe. And it used to be that Germany was the only one that could, you know, manage to rub two sticks together and create an economic fire in in Europe. But not anymore. Not since the Brexit. At least in the early stages, the doom and gloom isn't really panning out. They're doing quite well in terms of GDP, in terms of employment growth. And it's kind of got people a little bit shocked.
Right. Well, I think that also, I know that there was a lot of stuff that was being done with this concept called asset allocation, that you allocate the assets properly. And I'm assuming that in today's world, one of the things that there's going to be a lot of people looking at is with the government coming in and figuring out how to have non-accredited investors involved in early stage companies. All these crowdfunding type of opportunities are going to come up. And I would assume that somebody's got to tell these people, okay, if you're going to do this, maybe you ought to take some portion of what it is that you've got in your holdings to do something with that you might be able to do better than you put it in a bank. But I wouldn't go all whole hog about the whole thing because, you know, a lot of early stage companies, in fact, the majority of them fail. So and
yep.
when they fail, no, you're done.
You're exactly right. I mean, it's interesting to think of it in terms in because when I hear you speaking, I have to translate it into sort of my background.
Right.
And it's interesting how many corollaries there actually are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, asset allocation, sort of the, you know, simple old standard was take 100 and subtract your age from it. And that was part of the influence of Markowitz as well. So let's say, for instance, I took 100. I'm 30 years old, entrepreneurial guy. I took 100, and that meant that 70% of my holdings should be in stocks and 30% right. in some split between cash and bonds, okay?
Right.
Or vice versa. If I was a 70-year-old guy and I was getting ready to, you know, sail off into the sunset, I would subtract my age from 100. And so 30% of my holdings should be in stocks and 70% in some combination of cash and bonds.
Sure.
Well, if you're still using those old models, you've suffered over the last 8 years at least three major dilutions to sure. your holdings because they're not holding up anymore. So that's where the economic cycle becomes really important. So in a situation like this, so I'm in the camp that we're in late stage of an economic cycle. So a slowdown is just around the corner here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it. We saw it with GDP last week. Although there was a, you know, everybody was jumping and screaming about the quarter over quarter number of 2.29%. If you look at the real number, which is the only way you can get your head around the direction, was the year-over-year number, it came in lower at 1.5%,
right.
and it's actually headed lower. The probability of it heading lower with a quarter-over-quarter number that jumped up like 2.29% is even higher. So that's the way things just work out. And if you lift up, you know, you drill down and take a look under the hood, one-third of that number was soybean exports.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, yeah, okay. You know, Wall Street Journal came out, said it was a, you know, whole new world, and CNN was jumping up and down and really beating the drum on how great the economy was. But, you know, we're not going to do a lot of economic stabilization based on, you know, how much tofu we get out of the United States. So
right.
it's not happening that way. So you're back to the allocation question.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be done. Yes, because you got to listen to grandma. You can't have all your eggs in one basket,
right.
but it has to be done in a different way because the environment has changed so dramatically in the underlying economy.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing is that you have a lot of people now with the graying of America, of which I happen to be part of that. When you start to have money in a self-directed IRA because you want to protect it and you want to put it into a bank just in case something happens, at least you think that $250,000 of it's protected. But the interest rate that you get, you got to go out three decimal point places to pick it up. I
Oh, that's
mean,
absolutely right.
it's like you're almost like losing money because you're putting it there, but you're only putting it there because it's safe. And then the question is, okay, how long can you put up with that?
Well, that's right, and you know, I don't know that we're headed in that direction, but there's a probability for it, and that's negative interest rates, where you actually pay the banks to hold the money for you because it's safe. So, if you look at an environment like, you know, the late cycle slowdown that I'm talking about, what's worked phenomenally over the last 12 months have been things that people don't normally think about. Anything that looked like a utility, anything that looked like a municipal bond or a long-term government bond, anything that looked like gold, except for the gold miners, they were a little choppy. But commodities in general seem to do fairly well. Now, those things, you know, you can buy those through ETFs, and the ETF market is actually starting to surpass the actively managed mutual fund market. And there have been massive redemptions from mutual fund markets, and people just want to. And I think it's an age thing because, you know, millennials are like, okay, give me the algorithm and just let me, you know, let me figure it out from there. And I have this conversation all the time with, you know, the younger clients, and I'm like, well, if you want to do it on your own, that's fine, you know, but I don't know any algorithm that's going to help you with your estate planning or, you know, your asset protection strategy. So you might need somebody to talk to, even though you want to go with these passively managed funds, which are just fine. And the way that the assets that I just mentioned could be easily handled in the last 12 months were through ETFs. So you still have to think about asset allocation. You still have to think about not having everything in one place, but you have to think of it a little bit differently, actually quite a bit differently than we did, you know, certainly since the 70s, so over the last 40 years.
Well, you know, one of the things I also want to sort of specify now, because I know you agree with it, because it's in your book. Anything that we're talking about right now is not meant to be any recommendation of something that you should do. If there's something that's of interest, go talk to a financial advisor about it.
Oh man, I can't make any recommendations. They'll throw me in jail.
Of course, of course. But
So
you know,
no,
some people
anything I just said,
misinterpret
don't
it.
do.
Yeah, people misinterpret what it is. It's kind of like, oh no, it's financial advice. And the
Yes.
reason I said that was
Thank you.
given, yeah, sorry. Actually, anytime you have a book, I mean, I have a book, and in it, I had to put all kinds of things to just make sure that the FTC didn't come down and sort of fine me.
Yeah, I think my first page after the title is a giant disclaimer says, "Don't do anything that I say to do in this book."
Yes, it's I that's what I was just reading from. Because one of the things I wanted to ask you is that now that you think that there's this looming things that are going to happen, what are some areas that people should consider?
Well, here's the thing. You have to get a sort of a rock solid plan in place in order to take your mind off of this notion that you're going to get rich in the stock market. Okay, it's a good tool. It's an excellent tool, but you know when it has the ebbs and flows of a normal economic cycle, you want to be positioned for that, and you want to be positioned for it in a very smart and strategic way. The best way to do it, in my opinion, is to have certain things in place, like an emergency fund that is either 6 to 12 months of all of your expenses just covered, just sitting there waiting for something to happen. So if something does happen, you're not going to have to worry about it. So that brings you a little peace of mind. Having a rock solid, and this is particularly important for people with families. Is having a rock solid, and that's, you know, husband and wife, or you know, domestic partnerships, or whatever whatever the situation is. But if they have kids, that kind of thing, have a rock solid insurance portfolio where, you know, you've got a mixture of whole life term, you know, some sort of annuity structure going on, so that if anything else happens, you're covered. So if you get, you know, your skill set's in order and you're educated yourself and your work is going just fine and hopefully gangbusters because you're an entrepreneur. But you're focused all of your excess capital on the stock market, you're not going to get sleep at night. On the other hand, if you have a little money tucked under the mattress. You've got some, you know, actual gold coins in a safe deposit box. You've got some insurance that's got you covered for, you know, the eventuality that, you know, what you sprain your ankle or sure. worse. Then you don't have to focus on, you know, that big drive to get massive returns from the market. I don't think you're going to get them for a while anyway.
Right.
Maybe on a case-by-case basis, you still can. That may be true. But, you know, by the same token, you have to get yourself to a point where you just don't have to worry about it. So kind of what I advise people to do is to look the other way. Don't really turn all of your attention to the market. Turn your attention away to strategies that keep you calm and keep you focused and allow you to spend some time, quality time, without having to worry about all that stuff. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, how you defend against this kind of volatility. Right. And that's by just sort of stepping back a little bit.
Well, you know, the other thing that I think that people really have to be paying more closer attention to is a lot of what we put money away for is the future, and it ends up that people are living significantly longer than anybody ever anticipated. So what does that mean in terms of what kind of retirement fund do you have to have in place?
Oh, man, that's absolutely a great question. So, you know, I always try to tell clients, you know, my clients that, you know, typically work with me, they're making a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say, okay, let's say you retire and you say you want to, you know, put together an amount of money, and how does $1 million sound? And they said, yo, $1 million sounds great. If I had that, I'd be able to retire. And I say, okay, let's say we get 5% off of that $1 million, and we're just going to not spend any of the principal and live off of the interest, right? And they're like, yeah. I said, well, how much is that 5%? It's like $50,000.
Right.
Okay, so what kind of adjustment are you going to have to make from your income that you're making now, which is five times that?
Right.
To when you retire and you're just going to live off of a fifth. And they're like, ooh.
Yeah, most people don't get that. And most people really think that once they retire, there's going to be all these expenses out of their life. And it's not true. You still need 60 to 80% of what you were making when you were working in order to keep your lifestyle up.
That's right. And that means, you know, that means a lot of specialized planning. And, you know, I'm sorry, younger investors, I'm speaking straight to you. It's not going to happen from an algorithm. You got to talk to a guy like me.
Right. Well, that's actually, guy. You know, I got to tell you, I've really enjoyed this. And by the way, I told you the time would go fast, and it has. We're just coming up on just about the 23-minute mark. But I want to give you an opportunity to tell people how they can get in touch with you. Tell them where your book is, what name and title your book is, and where they can get it.
Okay, great. So the name of the book is The Family Man Stock Market Volatility Survival Guide, How to Defend Your Family in Any Economy. You can go on Amazon and find it there. You can go on my website, which is www.familymansmvsg.com. My work website is dfcwealth.com. You know, you can get the book on the website, on both of those websites. You can Google my name, Donald F. Carpenter Jr. By the way, if you Google Donald Carpenter, it's like some big Mohawk metal banger guy.
Right.
It's not me. So Donald F. Carpenter Jr., or you can Google The Family Man Stock Market Volatility Survival Guide, or you can just Google Family Man Stock Market, and the book comes right up. It's about 93 pages. It's got some really good information, how to get your act together, why you're working. I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that if you've got a family, then you've got to get your heart around your business. And that means you're not working for your boss, you're not working for your company, you're working for your family, the people that you love. So, you know, that's really, there's this big push to, you know, get guys to sort of reclaim that ownership of defending and protecting their families and starting with their finances.
Donald, it was a pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed it, and I hope a lot of people go out and buy your book and contact you, and you can help them live their lives out properly.
Well, I'm here in Southern California, Century City, and look forward to having people get the book. I mean, I really would like it if they would just buy it, not so much that it would, you know, ingratiate me, but I think I wrote it to help, and I hope it can help.
Thanks, and thanks for appearing on the show.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.